I love operating in productive tension. And I love stirring the pot. So
I've never heard that phrase before. I love that. Productive tension.
Welcome to AZ Uncensored, a podcast brought to you by Arizona Citizens for the Arts, where we seek to build transparency between arts and politics. I'm your new host, Madeline Slotin, and stay tuned.
Alrighty, well, welcome to AZ Uncensored. This is Madeline, your new host. Today is a special episode because I'm with Joseph, the old host, so this should be a fun conversation.
Just call me old.
I guess, yes.
I like that you're okay with that. She's like, yep.
Well, Joseph, I'm excited to, I guess, be in this position and be here today. It's been an exciting ride gearing up for this. So I really appreciate you kind of extending me the hand over here. And I guess I'm just wondering, like, what made you, we talked a little bit about it, but kind of what impassioned you to start this podcast, like what you saw getting out of it when you first began, I guess.
Thanks. Yeah. The reason for the podcast was really pretty simple. You know, I work for an advocacy organization. We both do now. You know, you're a part of Arizona Citizens for the Arts too. And what I realized in the last 18 months I've been here, and I was seeing this before, is that we as a society, and this is true for the arts as much as it is for anybody else, we're really bad at advocacy. We're really bad at getting involved in our own politics. Now, there's no binaries in the world, so that's certainly not true for everybody. But I do believe it's true for most people, and especially like the general population, especially kind of the mainstream people who politics and policies affect really deeply. They tend to be better at it. So you know, that tends to be, you know, more so, you know, people of color, indigenous people. Sometimes women, you know, other, you know, populations that are not governed in the same way that old white dudes like me are. But again, coming from the position of like working for Arizona Citizens for the Arts, I just wanted to find more ways to get more people involved. And of course, getting involved, the first thing you need to do is educate yourself. So I saw it as a different and maybe uniquely accessible way for people to start to get involved in advocacy more. So that was the gist of it.
Awesome. Yeah. And I think it's a really interesting way to kind of go about it. I think you learn a lot through conversation, and I don't know, I took a class where we talked about just like the power of relational meetings and how you build community through sharing each other's stories. So I don't know. I see this really as an experience to learn other people's stories. And I like how it's a mix of just working with art, learning the story through artist stories and through legislatures and seeing them as, you say a lot, like seeing them as like real people, like stripping them of that, like that weird disconnect that we usually have with legislators. So
yeah. Yeah. And I think you're referring to like our kind of our ongoing conversations. I just really want to kind of second that, because I know that was true for me and kind of some days still is. You know, we have this inherited culture where we think these, you know, elected officials are like above us, you know, because, you know, they have positions of authority, but that authority of course comes from voters in a democracy. And, you know, they sit at this big fancy building, you know, in our downtowns, whether that's our downtown cities or, you know, our downtown capital of the nation. So there's just a separation of them as humans. And we put them in these, you know, sort of imaginary pedestals. And that, I think, makes engagement worse. Like people feel uncomfortable talking to a legislator or a congressperson or, you know, a city council. Like, even I still feel nervous sometimes talking to them, which is silly because they truly do work for us. You know, they're elected by us. regardless of, you know, how you feel about, you know, how the elections turned out, they got there, but they're one of us. And then the other part that you talked about is kind of demystifying that is they're just ordinary people like right. you and me. And I'm still reminding myself of that. Like they, you know, they may smell funny. They tell bad jokes. Like these are ordinary people, just like everybody else. And I'm hoping that the more people see that, the more comfortable everybody is to get more engaged in their own politics.
Yeah, that's a little bit what I'm hoping as well. I think there's a lot of like, I don't know, the fear driven from talking to legislators and getting involved. It feels like they're tackling problems. I think from a privileged individual standpoint, they're tackling problems that are bigger than us. And it's kind of frustrating from like an advocacy standpoint, because these problems, none of them are, yeah, they impact millions to thousands to hundreds of people, but there's still a way to go about it. There's still a way to get involved. There's still a way to be a part of something bigger than you in a way that's not so intimidating. And I think just the only difference between, I guess, me and a legislature is they don't have maybe that much of that fear. They see that, like, they see their avenue, their job as a way to get involved. So, mm-hmm. or at least that's the hope.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And I think that it might even be true for like any sector. So like I have a theater background. And so I've spent literally hundreds of days of my life on a stage, either in rehearsal or in performance back when I was more involved. And now like I've been in spaces where we've held events on stage and people go into a theater if they're like on the stage, if they're not a theater person, and they're like, oh my gosh, like I'm on stage and this is so cool. And it's like ordinary to me. I've napped on stages before, you know, because you always do when you're in deep in rehearsals. So I wonder if that's, if maybe that applies to it too. Like these, any sector that we're not involved in, like daily process feels foreign. So I'm always hoping that this could be a part of making that more familiar and comfortable and for anybody and everybody.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely do. That brought back some nostalgia of the theater days, of the long hours of rehearsal, which can be crossed to any reference of the Congress people who are in committee for hours. But yeah, so thank you for that, kind of giving us that take on kind of where your head is at for in terms mm-hmm. of why you started this podcast. And I did want to kind of touch on just like with COVID and with Black Lives Matter and just everything, like how that transformed over your time just as a host, like how you tackled all those as you're currently living through history, how you're able to incorporate that into conversation, because that feels like it dominates my conversation nowadays, and how you juggle the different mm-hmm. topics, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but I think you just asked two big things. Cause you said COVID and Black Lives Matter, which do I take those together or separately?
I mean, they can be together and separate. That's the beauty of the disaster that we're living in.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Well, the, you know, together, I mean, there's certainly, I think there's a truth there. You know, we know sadly, as has always been true in our nation's history, that it is people of color that are more affected, you know, getting infected at higher rates, they're getting vaccinated at a lower rate, et cetera. So that's, you know, certainly a big part of it. COVID, I'll be honest. I've said this to a few people that I know closely. COVID was really, really hard on me personally, as it was on everybody. But I can't believe I'm going to say this on a recorded situation. I think I experienced a depression or a version of depression for the first time in my life this summer. You know, like late spring, summer. And the reason why I wanted to qualify it with like light, you know, or a version of depression is because I know from friends and family how real and massive depression can be for people, you know, and how paralyzing it can be, and how society still struggles with making that like a normal thing to talk about because it's hidden. You know, it's not like a broken arm where you've got the cast and people want to sign it and it becomes kind of a fun story. Depression and other things that affect the mind are still not talked about and it's still not understood. So for me, that's kind of one place where COVID was. It was really hard on our organization as it was on all arts organizations. There's probably a fair argument to say that the arts sector was the hardest hit because of this global pandemic. And then maybe like hospitality, you know, hotels and restaurants are probably, you know, right up there with it. I don't think it's a competition, but so that was hard, you know, seeing all my friends and colleagues be out of work and not able to find work and, you know, building is closed. And then the third piece, which kind of circles around to the depression, is I'm very much a pretty classic extrovert. And that was hard. I mean, extroverts get a lot of undue credit in our society because oftentimes the loudest voices in the room win, even if we don't have the, you know, the best things to say, but extroverts tend to do better in our society. And this one I do feel like was extra hard on extroverts because I get recharged by seeing people, by hearing their stories, by talking to them, by listening. And so, yeah, COVID, I think, helped me experience some depression in a way that I had not before. And I think kind of in hindsight, I get to be a little bit grateful for that. I mean, I already knew it was real because of my mom and other friends of mine. And then, yeah, did I touch on anything you were interested in on the COVID side there? I didn't know where to go with that.
Yeah, I just wanted to see how that impacted your work, your personal life. I know I've been asking a lot of folks that because, I don't know, for people who are in the arts, like you said, you're a classic extrovert and people kind of use arts as a way to connect. Mm-hmm. And then COVID took away our opportunity to connect. And I'm weirdly an introvert. So I thought that COVID would be a pleasant surprise. I know that sounds terrible.
It's okay.
But I thought it'd be a time for me to, you know, do what I like doing, which is being like in constant solitude, I guess. But I don't know. I think for me, it made me not feel like myself and like using like looking at arts therapy. I use arts very like therapeutically. I connect to music and theater in a therapeutic way. And I was unable to do that. I wasn't singing anymore. I stopped singing in the shower. Like it felt like it really disconnected me from myself. And then I think when you layer like Black Lives Matter movement to that, then that added I never really felt connected to American democracy, but it revealed that added disconnect that I have not to myself, but like also to society. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sorry that it affected you that way too. I'm glad you said that because actually I have not heard that much from introverts, although I certainly believe it's true for a lot of introverts, is that, you know, it didn't, again, there's probably this like idea of this silver lining, like, yay, I have a good excuse to be alone. But introverts still like people. They just, you know, operate in the world in a different way as I understand it.
Right.
And then, yeah. And then, sorry, go ahead. You go.
No, I was going to say exactly. One of my friends once told me that like, as an introvert, it's not that you don't like people. It's that you need the time. You don't get your energy from people and you kind of get your energy from self-reflection, but it's like, you're in that constant self-reflection. I'm never getting to exert all this pent up energy, I guess. That's what it feels like.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And to be fair, I have a house here in Phoenix, and my brother and his wife and my niece all live with me. So I was around people, and I don't know if you'll ever listen to this. I love you all very much, but I also didn't plan to spend, 12 months, day in and day out with them. As much as I love them, and my brother is my hero and my best friend, but there was something to that, which, everybody's stranded on their own little deserted island, with whoever they're stranded with, whether it's by yourself or, with immediate family members. I'd be curious to know what the statistics are on marriages after this, not to be like too crass, but like, I wonder if this will, in as a trend, help or hurt marriages or life partnerships,
That's true. That's a good
Have you heard of anything like that about people that are, maybe it's only because people only talk about the good stuff publicly, but I've actually only heard good stories from my friends who are married or partnered.
I'm not surrounded by a lot of married folk. I'm surrounded by a lot of broken families. So I'm really not sure how the only married folk that I'm surrounded that I know closely are my grandparents, who are out of work. So COVID didn't change much for them.
Right. If I may, I'd like to keep going on the Black Lives Matter part of that question too.
Yeah,
and I'm really grateful for you to ask that, because it is so important, and it is such a moment to see that. And my understanding of it, of course, is it was limited as a white dude, but really I'm just somebody who has always liked to study the good data and then pair it up with the personal stories. And it's kind of ironic to me that it would still be a question, like people would still, if they see Black Lives Matter, which they'll see on my cover photo of my Facebook, or they see it a flag, and they will react and they'll say all lives matter. It's so silly that people say that, because I don't think they understand what it means even after all this time. And I've actually had this conversation with family members, and here's my description to them. It's like, okay, if you see a board, like a billboard that has the picture of a child, and it says, let's end child abuse, children's lives matter, do you stop your car and say, hey, all lives matter? And do you shout that at that billboard? Or if you're talking to a friend, about human trafficking and how like prostitution and human trafficking still happens around the world and has increased in our country every time a Super Bowl shows up, and they say, hey, let's help out, these women who have been victimized, do you shout back at them, all lives matter?
Right.
And I know people don't do that, or, if we have, veteran or military who are in concentration camps, and we've got the POW flags, and we have one in our house, because my brother's my half brother, his dad was a POW, which says, POW lives matter. Do you stop and shout back, hey, all lives matter? So this was obviously a long way to say to anybody who still has a hard time understanding that, it's all it's saying is, let's pay attention to areas that need to be addressed in our society. We need to address child abuse. We need to address, Black people being treated and paid equally. We need to address human trafficking. We need to address PTSD with our veterans and our military. Like, we can do all of this. We have the capacity to do all of this as humans, who I think are usually good. So hopefully that reaches at least one person to say, please stop saying all lives matter, because they do. We're just saying, let's look at these moments and these different, subsets of our population that are still struggling under historical crap that we've inherited.
Right. I think where my frustration comes is, I get frustrated. People are so stuck on the liberals and conservatives alike get stuck on jargon. And I think for advocacy workers, it's like super frustrating because I don't know, Black Lives Matter just as a whole this past summer was just frustrating in a way where I wasn't getting a whole lot of, I wasn't feeling personally empowered by all the statements and the black squares and the BLM and your bio. And it's just scary when I see movements, social movements get monetized, or I get see these large corporations put like, we say that Black Lives Matter, or when I see individuals, organizations say like, we, it's not that I don't want them to acknowledge, but I also get frustrated because I want to know what goes beyond that. I want to know that you're hiring Black lives, or that you're individually voting on against structures that are limiting the capacity for Black excellence, and that you're not supporting cops. Like, these are all like, these are all elements of Black Lives Matter that I feel like, I don't know, the last couple months don't feel talked about enough. Or it's like, Black Lives Matter, but not to the extent of defunding the police, or Black Lives Matter, but not to the extent of targeting universal healthcare so that way more Black lives have access. Like, so yeah. That's frustration.
I'm really glad you said that, because this is a conversation I struggle with as well. And if anybody knows me, they know I've been having versions of these conversations, although initially in my life, probably much lighter versions. And I agree, like message, like putting a message up or putting a cover photo up on like on my Facebook page is not enough. It's, you know, it's nice. And I'm quoting air quotes for our listeners out there. I'm air quoting, you know, nice, but it's certainly not enough until people do things like, you know, activate in public spaces, or as you said, businesses, you know, put in different hiring practices. It's not enough. The one thing I don't know if this is actually a counterpoint, but maybe I just want to add to the conversation, because I actually had a conversation very similar to this with a couple of colleagues. And for me, this is really the space between what I call the hyperbole and the nuance. Because, like, you know, the strong and truthful statements are that, you know, Black people are being shot at a higher rate of white people, like by the police. It's just a fact. Like, go check it out with the FBI or your local police, if they even publish those reports, which they often don't. You know, that's just an empirical piece of data. Like, Black people are shot more often than white people, even though white people can commit more crimes in our country. So there's like one end of the knowledge that we have to know. On the other end of the spectrum of like the conversations, you know, putting something up on Instagram, I don't want to personally, and anybody can disagree with me, I don't want to totally discount those, because the conversation I had with colleagues was somebody had seen a sign like up in their window, like it was a business, and they had a sign, you know, Black Lives Matter. And one of my colleagues said, that's not enough, you know, for them just to put up a sign. And I said, again, like trying to hold these things at the same time. On one hand, I agree we want to do more. On the other hand, we don't know their business clientele. We don't know, you know, who they are, or who they serve, or how much money they make. And for a local business to put a sign up saying Black Lives Matter, that may or may not, but that might jeopardize their client base. And then they don't get as many customers, and then they go out of business. So sometimes I think those things can be risky for people. You know, change doesn't happen without risk. You have to have skin in the game, you know, and I guess that's probably a pun, but I didn't mean it to be, but you have to have, you know, your own body or your own money, you know, or your own family, or, you know, you have to have something in the game. You have to risk something in your life for any real change to happen. So I also, you know, for me, I want to hold all those things. I want to be able to speak truth And I want to be able to recognize that everybody is doing things differently, not to make them comfortable, but to say, I don't know your journey, you know, and maybe you're a white owned business who's never done this before and you're putting your business at risk just for putting a sign out. And I want to take, you know, one tiny moment, you know, to celebrate that and say, look, you're on the path. You know, I don't want to kick anybody off of path just because for me, it doesn't look like enough. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think, I don't know, I think there's room for both. Like you said, live in that nuance. I think there's room for both critiques. I think what I want for individuals to understand, and what I'm probably going to talk a lot about there on this journey, on this podcast, is it's okay for it to not be enough. Like, it's okay for, I need people to stay uncomfortable to the point where if a Black person stands up and says your BLM is not enough, it's not enough, you know, just because it's frustrating for somebody who has lived the experience as a Black person, as an Indigenous person, as a Latinx person, as LGBTQ plus individual, who has to face adversity every day. And then for, I guess, over the summer to see people buying books on the structures, like what is white supremacy, and what, it's awesome to see, but it's frustrating because it shows me like that really sharp disconnect between myself and somebody else, to the point where I had to learn racism at 5 years old when the kids wouldn't play with me because of my skin color, versus like somebody who saw it on TV, who was friend wasn't affected at their 20-year-old stage in life. So I guess it's just frustrating because it's so good to see people starting to stand up, but it's so frustrating to see people who have been standing up for years and who just don't have the platform. And I think that's hopefully what I want to get out of this space, is to elevate others' platform who have worked years to show that these impacts on minorities that we're seeing going on in the streets is something that's been happening since the start of time. Mm-hmm. since this time when our founding fathers were owning slaves, like, and for people to know that history. And I think what's so important about arts education is it's a creative way to tell these stories that if kids heard that Christopher Columbus was the villain when they were kids and not celebrating him, then maybe we wouldn't have this disconnect where my best friend is learning about racism at 21 years old and I learned about it at 4-5 years old. So mm-hmm. I think both arguments need to exist in this space. I think people, mm-hmm. as a way to be energized as an activist, you need that pat on that back and that validation to say like you are on the right path. But to keep you going, you also need that critique of this is not enough, you know?
Yep.
So.
Yeah, I totally agree. I want both. And I want people, because change, just like it doesn't happen without risk, it also doesn't happen, like, change is not comfortable. You know, we're humans, we're animals that want to be like in the status quo. You know, we want to just coast along and feel fine. So I totally agree. You know, we need both. I just don't want to jettison somebody because it may look like they are not doing enough, and maybe it's the first thing they've done, and for them it's a start, and I want to figure out ways to keep them coming.
But I also want people to understand where that in Flagstaff we have a really interesting culture where we have this divide between activists. Right now you have activists who are been working on the electoral sides of things and have built a strong community for Indigenous rights, because we do have a large Indigenous population here mm-hmm. who are disproportionately affected by police relations. And you have this other side of activists who are outraged and are like refusing to work with certain groups because they feel like what you're doing is not enough, how you're not contributing to putting power back into the Indigenous community by allowing police at your protests, or by coddling white fragility in your meetings. And I think mm-hmm. both, and I've had like a really interesting path here, because I think both are completely accurate. And it was the moment where somebody told me that my rage is valid, and if I scream past the rooftop saying what you're doing is not enough and you feel uncomfortable with that, I'm not apologizing for that, because
right.
my experience allows me to be angry about things mm-hmm. and I'm not, like this person told me, they're like, I'm not gonna coddle people who are seemingly on the same side as me, because until they can get radical they don't feel mm-hmm. like they're really on the same side. And so, but I also see, like, we all have different journeys, and I also see from the other side of things where, like, you know, I'm just getting into this. I'm just putting my feet in the water. You know, you can't dive in head first without crashing all the time. So, yeah.
I was a dive in head first kid in the pool. So growing up.
Right.
Yeah, because the problem with what I just said, I mean, to counterpoint myself, is what I just said can be taken as, you know, wanting to meet people where they are, you know, or catering to white fragility. And that's absolutely not where that comment lives in my heart, you know, but it's about, you know, how do we, you know, find and encourage more allies. I will say, if I may, I want to, you know, direct, you know, this comment at any white dudes, you know, like me in our society, is, if anybody's listening and happens to look like me, this work is going to take generations, and we need to be okay with being, you know, uncomfortable, because we get to drive down the street without fear of being pulled over based on the color of our skin. We get to walk through stores without being followed around. We currently still get paid more than anybody else, than women, people of color, anybody else. Nobody asks us in an interview where, you know, where we're from, because we don't have an accent. So all of these tiny little privileges that add up to one big giant privilege that we did not invent, you know, and I don't say this out of guilt. I have no guilt, you know, for what our country is, but I do feel a sense of responsibility to try to do better every day than I did, you know, the day before. And that it means it's every day, you know, having these conversations to some degree, or pushing on yourself or questioning your own behavior. And it's uncomfortable. I've been honestly having this conversation for most of my adult life. And if not even, I know a few times as a kid, and it's still not comfortable, and I'm still going to do it. Not that I'm anything special or smarter than anybody else. I just, A, believe the empirical data, and B, believe all the stories of my friends who, like you said, you know, what I think I heard you say, you know, are angry and suffering and living in fear, oftentimes by our people that are supposed to protect us. So in out of responsibility, just as a human, I'm going to try to always be more uncomfortable and be more a part of the change. And I want anybody else to do the same.
Yeah. And I think it's important that I think the human aspect is really important. Like, nobody's going to be a perfect activist or a perfect ally. And it's okay to take time. There's been a lot of critique on, like, a few months after the Black Lives Matter just circulated social media, I started to see infographics about, like, activist fatigue. And there was a lot of critiques about it. But I also... and I'm not ever going to speak on behalf of all Black individuals, but me as an individual, I didn't necessarily agree with the critique, because I think everybody, Black, white, what, whoever, needs the time to take away and to recharge, and to, because it's going to be, if you're white and you want to get involved, it's going to be hard, because you're going to have to get uncomfortable, because you're going to have to realize that the spaces that you exist in, that the privileges that you're allowed in those spaces compromise other people, and just from exist, you know, just from existing. And that's a hard pill to swallow. But I also want people in that same breath to understand that, like, you're going to experience rage, you're going to experience unapologetic rage, and you're going to experience anger and hurt that you'll never be able to understand, and really, frankly, it's not your job to understand. So yeah, I hope to kind of get through all those nuances.
I'm glad you said that, because it actually makes me think, you know, like, of these new experiences. It makes me think of a story. And again, I really want to direct this towards any white dudes like me. So I was actually in a room. I'm trying to do this without, like, I'm trying to give you enough kind of detail. So it was in a place that I worked with colleagues, you know, so these are people that I work with. And this was actually right after Me Too really broke big, you know, nationwide. And I've been taught, and I agree with the sentiment, that in spaces where you, like, want to talk about social change and justice and equity, that it can be a good thing for a white dude like me, with, you know, with the privileges that come with being born in this country, to open up the conversation, to, like, be vulnerable, to, like, to just try to say, hey, this, you know, I'm inviting this work into this space, because we do hold, you know, an imbalanced amount of, you know, power or privilege in a room. So I did that. So I opened up and I said, hey, you know, Me Too is really, like, emerging right now. And I just want to acknowledge that, you know, in my life, I've made, you know, mistakes. Certainly when I was younger, I told inappropriate jokes. I'm sure, even though I don't think it happened a lot, I'm sure that I looked at, you know, women, and maybe made somebody feel uncomfortable, you know, and I just wanted to kind of call myself out and say that I participated in, you know, this male dominant culture. And then somebody, after I said that, because it happened to be a room full of mostly people identifying as female, somebody spoke up and said, and let's also look at the man doing all the talking in a room full of women. So like, both of these were true. So I was trying to be vulnerable and share, you know, that I'm a part of the problem. And even in the moment of being vulnerable, someone called out that also the truth, that I was the man doing all the talking in a room full of women.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I was saying before, like, you know, we're going to be uncomfortable kind of no matter what, and that's okay. Like, if this change, this kind of social change is not fun, this is what I call, and this is my own thing, and I'm happy to, like, share it, but, like, this is what I call the social rights revolution. It's like, we had the civil rights revolution, which changed a bunch of laws, you know, made things better on paper, but of course it didn't change perceptions. You know, a lot of the people that fought against civil rights are still in power, you know, in Congress, or their brothers and sisters or their kids are in power. So it didn't change any of the social norms. It didn't change racism, you know, when we had laws to protect people of color in public spaces, like, and try to pay women more equally. Like, it didn't change our feelings that got us to that place as a country. So what I see now is that we're in this social rights revolution where people are saying, hey, like, y'all did a lot of good work, you know, changing laws. Can we actually start to put, like, the feeling and the humanity behind those now?
Right. A lot of the, kind of what I gather from you saying is, social change and political change are different, and they've been showcased very differently. And that's kind of that's the issue, I guess, with electoral politics that people don't understand, is it only changes one aspect for the movement. And then now it's one thing to change actions, but it's another thing to change hearts and minds. And so that'll take generations, obviously, but
yeah. Well, thankfully I'm handing that off to you to do that through, you know, AZ Uncensored. So you get to do this now with this podcast, and I'm sure everything will change. And everything will be perfect in a few months after you're running it.
I hope so.
No pressure, no pressure.
No pressure at all.
Can I flip the script? Can I ask you, as the new host, how are you feeling about this and this new social political vehicle called a podcast called AZ Uncensored?
I don't know. I feel it's mixed feelings. On one hand, I don't feel super intimidated by it because it's pretty easy to get into a conversation, which is what, you know, we strive for. But I guess it's kind of the hardest part is getting people to really open up and be vulnerable and say things and engage with things that they don't want to. I love operating in productive tension. And I love stirring the pot. So
I've never heard that phrase before. I love that. Productive tension.
Yeah, I feel like tension can be productive if that's what you're striving for. So
I'm writing that down.
Awesome. Yeah. So I think it's just kind of navigating that, and how do I get people to really just say what they feel?
Productive tension. Awesome.
Yeah. So
yeah, and I found that a little bit more on the podcast, if I may. You probably know this, but like I found that to be the easier conversations, were with the artists, when you're in my experience, which is limited. I think I only did, 15 episodes or so. It was a little harder to get the politicians there, only because they're so used to talking in public. I think the stump speech,
right,
the talking points are pretty ingrained in them, which I imagine they have to be, cause they all have like their causes. They're like top three or five causes. So in my experience, and I don't know if it'll be yours, that was, one of the challenges is to get them down to this, like, hey, imagine we're just sitting around, having a cup of coffee or some other beverage to just kind of shoot the shit. I don't know if I can say that on our podcast, but I just did.
AZ Uncensored. Yeah, I predict that will probably be pretty similar. So it's just kind of navigating that in a productive way. I feel like there's a difference between regular tension and productive tension. So that's like the thing that I'm kind of, but that's what I strive for personally when I have conversations. So I'm looking forward to hopefully some personal growth with that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess that's my biggest, I don't know if it's a concern, but just potential obstacle, I guess.
Well, I'm excited for you to take this on and excited for its future and your future for, when I met you the first time, I don't know if people know your history with us, but there was a potential internship, but you left a big impression on us just, with your spirit and, your focus on the world. And I'm honored that you were able and willing to take this on. I think you'll take it to a whole new level. And I mean, again, no pressure, but just by being you, it's going to be awesome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Appreciate the sentiments.
This might be an inadvertent plug because I am just really curious, but we're on air together, I'm recording together. Do you have any guests that you're either trying to get or that you have lined up that you're excited about already, or maybe some like who would be like a dream guest, any Any names that come to mind in any of those realms?
I don't know if I have a dream guest. There is some local like graffiti artists who, there's some in Flagstaff and there's some in Phoenix, who have been addressing just like the criminalization of homelessness. And that is like the forefront of my mind right now on like policing alternatives. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. they have sketched up some really cool art, but I have zero names and zero contacts. So I'm just kind of like, you know, talking around with people about like, you know, do you know who these people are? But, and just some local artists who have been working on like people experiencing homelessness and that impact, especially right now with the country freezing. And I don't know, I just wanted to talk to them and see and have a really cool conversation, because I am learning a lot about homelessness right now and mm-hmm. its relation to policing. And so I'd love to talk to them. I guess that's my closest to like a dream guest, you could say.
Okay. Well, hit me up after this, because I have a couple of people here who work in that realm, and I know a couple of people, so I'd be happy to help. And now we're putting it out to the universe, so you know, who knows, maybe they'll come your way. Are you okay giving your email to anybody who's listening on that, like the, like you said, the homelessness you know, situation?
Yes. My email is, I'll give my Arizona Citizens for the Arts email.
Yeah. I only say that because I've experienced this like in podcasts, like when you're listening to it, like, because I've written in a couple of podcasts, I'm like, oh, I want to know like that address, like as soon as they say it, because otherwise I'll forget to like write it down.
Okay. So for those listening, my email is Madeline, so that's MATALYNN at azcitizensforthearts.org. Yes, so if you know any people who are plugged into art that reflects all the things I just said, please let me know, because I'd love to talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is awesome. I'm really happy we got to do this. I'm even more excited now from having done this, you know, this kind of handoff episode with you, Madeline. I'm inspired by you, and I'm honored to be working with you.
No, I'm honored to be here. So definitely thank you for the opportunity. And I am very excited.
Nice. All right. Well, then we will see you around.
See you around. Thank you so much, Joseph, for being my guest today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on the other side of the mic.
Awesome. All right.
All right.